extremely depressed. She said, "I cry a lot, too, you know. I don't see you cry a lot. Maybe that's because I don't want you to see me cry a lot." "Why not?" "Because that isn't fair to either of us." "Yes, it is. I want us to move on." "How much do you cry?" "How much? A spoonful, a cup, a bathtub, if you added it up." "It doesn't work like that."
"Like what?"
She said, "I'm trying to find ways to be happy. Laughing makes me happy." I said, "I'm not trying to find ways to be happy, and I won't." She said, "Well, you should." "Why?" "Because Dad would want you to be happy. Dad would want me to remember him." "Why can't you remember him and be happy? Why are you in love with Ron?" "What? You're obviously in love with him, so what I want to know is why. What's so great about him?" "Oscar, did it ever occur to you that things might be more complicated than they seem?" "That occurs to me all the time." "Ron is my friend." "So then promise me you won't ever fall in love again." "Oscar, Ron is going through a lot, too. We help each other. We're friends. Promise me you won't fall in love." "Why would you ask me to promise that? Either promise me you'll never fall in love again, or I'm going to stop loving you." "You're not being fair." "I don't have to be fair. I'm your son." She let out an enormous breath and said, "You remind me so much of Dad." And then I said something that I wasn't planning on saying and didn't even want to say. As it came out of my mouth, I was ashamed that it was mixed with any of Dad's cells that I might have inhaled when we went to visit Ground Zero. If I could have chosen, I would have chosen you. She looked at me for a second, then stood up and walked out of the room. I wish she'd slammed the door, but she didn't. She closed it carefully like she always did. I could hear that she didn't walk away. Extremely depressed. No. Incredibly alone. "Mom?" Nothing. I got out of bed and went to the door. "I take it back." She didn't say anything, but I could hear her breathing. I put my hand on the doorknob because I thought maybe her hand was on the doorknob on the other side. I said, "I take it back." "You can't take something like that back." "Can you apologize for something like that?" "Nothing." "Do you accept my apology?" "I don't know." "How can you not know? Oscar, I don't know." "Are you mad at me?" "Nothing." "Mom?" "Yes?" "Are you still mad at me?"
"No."
"Are you sure?"
"I was never mad at you."
"What were you?"
"Hurt."
"Incredibly alone."
"No."
I guess I fell asleep on the floor. When I woke up, Mom was pulling my shirt off to help me get into my PJs, which means she must have seen all of my bruises. I counted them last night in the mirror, and there were 41. Some of them have gotten big, but most of them are small. I don't put them there for her, but still, I want her to ask me how I got them, even though she probably knows, and to feel sorry for me, because she should realize how hard things are for me, and to feel terrible because at least some of it is her fault, and to promise me that she won't die and leave me alone. But she didn't say anything. I couldn't even see the look in her eyes when she saw the bruises, because my shirt was over my head, covering my face like a pocket. Or a skull.
My feelings. They are announcing flights over the speakers. We are not listening. They do not matter to us because we are not going anywhere. I miss you already, Oscar. I missed you even when I was with you. That's been my problem. I miss what I already have, and I surround myself with things that are missing. Every time I put in a new page, I look at your grandfather. I am so relieved to see his face. It makes me feel safe. His shoulders are pinched. His spine is curved. In Dresden, he was a giant. I'm glad that his hands are still rough. The sculptures never left them. I didn't notice until now that he is still wearing his wedding ring. I wonder if he put it on when he came back, or if he wore it all those years. Before I came here, I locked up the apartment. I turned off the lights and made sure none of the faucets leaked. It's hard to say goodbye to the place you've lived. It can be as hard as saying goodbye to a person. We moved in after we were married. It had more room than his apartment. We needed it. We needed room for all of the animals, and we needed room between us. Your grandfather bought the most expensive insurance policy. A man from the company came over to take pictures. If anything happened, they would be able to rebuild the apartment again exactly as it was. He took a roll of film. He took a picture of the floor, a picture of the fireplace, a picture of the bathtub. I never confused what I had with what I was. When the man left, your grandfather took out his own camera and started taking more pictures. "What are you doing?" I asked him. "Better safe than sorry," he wrote. At the time I thought he was right, but I am not sure anymore. He took pictures of everything, of the undersides of the shelves in the closet, of the backs of the mirrors, even the broken things, the things you would not want to remember. He could have rebuilt the apartment by taping together the pictures. And the doorknobs. He took a picture of every doorknob in the apartment, every one, as if the world and its future depended on each doorknob. As if we would be thinking about doorknobs, should we ever actually need to use the pictures of them. I don't know why that hurt me so much. I told him, "They are not even nice doorknobs." He wrote, "But they are our doorknobs." I was his, too. He never took pictures of me, and we didn't buy life insurance. He kept one set of the pictures in his dresser. He taped another set into his day books, so they'd always be with him in case something happened at home. Our marriage was not unhappy, Oscar. He knew how to make me laugh, and sometimes I made him laugh. We had to make rules, but who doesn't? There is nothing wrong with compromising, even if you compromise almost everything. He got a job at a jewelry store because he knew the machines. He worked so hard that they made him assistant manager and then manager. He did not care about jewelry. He hated it. He used to say, "Jewelry is the opposite of sculpture." But it was a living, and he promised me that was okay. We got our own store in a neighborhood that was next to a bad neighborhood. It was open from 11 in the morning until 6 at night. But there was always work to be done. We spent our lives making livings. Sometimes he would go to the airport after work. I asked him to get me papers and magazines. At first, this was because I wanted to learn American expressions, but I gave up on that. I still asked him to go, I knew that he needed my permission to go. It was not out of kindness that I sent him. We tried so hard. We were always trying to help each other. But not because we were helpless. He needed to get things for me, just as I needed to get things for him. It gave us purpose. Sometimes I would ask him for something that I did not even want, just to let him get it for me. We spent our days trying to help each other, help each other. I would get his slippers. He would make my tea. I would turn up the heat so he could turn up the air conditioner so I could turn up the heat. His hands didn't lose their roughness. It was Halloween, our first in the apartment. The doorbell rang. Your grandfather was at the airport. I opened the door, and a child was standing there in a white sheet with holes cut out for her eyes. "Trick or treat," she said. I took a step back. "Who is that?" "I'm a ghost." "What are you wearing that for?" "It's Halloween."
"I don't know what that means."
"Kids dress up and knock on doors, and you give them candy."
"I don't have any candy."
"It's Halloween." I told her to wait. I went to the bedroom. I took an envelope from underneath the mattress. Our savings.
Our living.
I took out two $100 bills and put them in a different envelope, which I gave to the ghost. I was paying her to go away. I closed the door and turned off the lights so no more children would ring our bell. The animals must have understood because they surrounded me and pressed into me. I did not say anything when your grandfather came home that night. I thanked him for the papers and magazines. I went to the guest room and pretended to write. I hit the space bar again and again and again. My life story was spaces. The days passed one at a time, and sometimes less than one at a time. We looked at each other and drew maps in our heads. I told him my eyes were crummy because I wanted him to pay attention to me. We made safe places in the apartment where you could go and not exist. I would have done anything for him. Maybe that was my sickness. We made love in nothing places and turned the lights off. It felt like crying. We could not look at each other. It always had to be from behind, like that first time. And I knew that he wasn't thinking of me. He squeezed my side so hard and pushed so hard, like he was trying to push through me to somewhere else. Why does anyone ever make love? A year passed, another year, another year, another. We made livings. I never forgot about the ghost. I needed a child. What does it mean to need a child? One morning I awoke and understood the hole in the middle of me. I realized that I could compromise my life, but not life after me. I couldn't explain it. The need came before explanations. It was not out of weakness that I made it happen, but it was not out of strength either. It was out of need. I needed a child. I tried to hide it from him. I tried to wait to tell him until it was too late to do anything about it. It was the ultimate secret. Life. I kept it safe inside me. I took it around, like the apartment was inside his books. I wore loose shirts. I sat with pillows on my lap. I was naked only in nothing places. But I could not keep it a secret forever. We were lying in bed in the darkness. I did not know how to say it. I knew, but I could not say it. I took one of his day books from the bedside table. The apartment had never been darker. I turned on the lamp. It became bright around us. The apartment became darker. I wrote, "I am pregnant." I handed it to him. He read it. He took the pen and wrote, "How could that have happened?" I wrote, "I made it happen." He wrote, "But we had a rule." The next page was a doorknob. I turned the page and wrote, "I broke the rule." He sat up in bed. I don't know how much time passed. He wrote, "Everything will be okay." I told him okay wasn't enough. "Everything will be..." He crossed out okay and wrote perfect. I told him there was nothing left for a lie to protect. "Everything will be..." He crossed out perfect. I started to cry. It was the first time I had ever cried in front of him. It felt like making love. I asked him something I had needed to know since we made that first nothing place years before. What are we? Something or nothing? He covered my face with his hands and lifted them off. I did not know what that meant. The next morning I woke up with a terrible cold. I did not know if the baby was making me sick or if your grandfather was. When I said goodbye to him before he left for the airport, I lifted his suitcase and it felt heavy. That was how I knew he was leaving me. I wondered if I should stop him, if I should wrestle him to the ground and force him to love me. I wanted to hold his shoulders down and shout into his face. I followed him there. I watched him all morning. I did not know how to talk to him. I watched him write in his book. I watched him ask people what time it was, although each person just pointed at the big yellow clock on the wall. It was so strange to see him from a distance. So small. I cared for him in the world as I could not care for him in the apartment. I wanted to protect him from all the terrible things that no one deserves. I got very close to him, just behind him. I watched him write, "It's a shame that we have to live, but it's a tragedy that we get to live only one life." I stepped back. I could not be that close, not even then. From behind a column I watched him write more, and ask for the time, and rub his rough hands against his knees. Yes and no. I watched him get in the line to buy tickets. I wondered, when am I going to stop him from leaving? I didn't know how to ask him, or tell him, or beg him. When he got to the front of the line, I went up to him. I touched his shoulder. "I can see," I said. What a stupid thing to say. "My eyes are crummy, but I can see." "What are you doing here?" he wrote with his hands. I felt suddenly shy. I was not used to shy. I was used to shame. Shyness is when you turn your head away from something you want. Shame is when you turn your head away from something you do not want. "I know you are leaving," I said. "You have to go home," he wrote. "You should be in bed." "Okay," I said. I did not know how to say what I needed to say. "Let me take you home." "No, I don't want to go home." He wrote, "You are being crazy. You are going to catch a cold." "I already have a cold." "You are going to catch a colder." I couldn't believe he was making a joke, and I couldn't believe I laughed. The laughter sent my thoughts to our kitchen table, where we would laugh and laugh. That table was where we were close to each other. It was instead of our bed. Everything in our apartment got confused. We would eat on the coffee table in the living room instead of at the dining room table. We wanted to be near the window. We filled the body of the grandfather clock with his empty day books, as if they were time itself. We put his filled day books in the bathtub of the second bathroom because we never used it. I sleepwalk when I sleep at all. Once I turned on the shower. Some of the books floated, and some stayed where they were. When I woke the next morning, I saw what I had done. The water was gray with all of his days. "I am not being crazy," I told him. "You have to go home." "I got tired," I told him. "Not worn out, but worn through, like one of those wives who wakes up one morning and says, 'I can't bake any more bread.'" "You never baked bread," he wrote, and we were still joking. "Then it's like I woke up and baked bread," I said, and we were joking even then. I wondered, will there come a time when we won't be joking? And what would that look like? And how would that feel? When I was a girl, my life was music that was always getting louder. Everything moved me. A dog following a stranger, that made me feel so much. A calendar that showed the wrong month, I could have cried over it. I did. Where the smoke from a chimney ended. How an overturned bottle rested at the edge of a table. I spent my life learning to feel less. Every day I felt less. Is that growing old? Or is it something worse? You cannot protect yourself from sadness without protecting yourself from happiness. He hid his face in the covers of his daybook, as if the covers were his hands. He cried. For whom was he crying? For Anna? For his parents? For me? For himself? I pulled the book from him. It was wet with tears running down the pages, as if the book itself were crying. He hid his face in his hands. "Let me see you cry," I told him. "I do not want to hurt you," he said, by shaking his head left to right. "It hurts me when you do not want to hurt me," I told him. "Let me see you cry." He lowered his hands. On one cheek it said, "Yes," backward. On one cheek it said, "No," backward. He was still looking down. Now the tears did not run down his cheeks, but fell from his eyes to the ground. "Let me see you cry," I said. I did not feel that he owed it to me, and I did not feel that I owed it to him. We owed it to each other, which is something different. He raised his head and looked at me. "I am not angry with you," I told him. "You must be. I am the one who broke the rule. But I am the one who made the rule you couldn't live with." My thoughts are wandering, Oscar. They are going to Dresden, to my mother's pearls, damp with the sweat of her neck. My thoughts are going up the sleeve of my father's overcoat. His arm was so thick and strong, I was sure it would protect me for as long as I lived. And it did, even after I lost him. The memory of his arm wraps around me as his arm used to. Each day has been chained to the previous one. But the weeks have had wings. Anyone who believes that a second is faster than a decade did not live my life. "Why are you leaving me?" He wrote, "I do not know how to live." "I do not know either, but I am trying." "I do not know how to try." There were things I wanted to tell him, but I knew they would hurt him. So I buried them, and let them hurt me. I put my hand on him. Touching him has always been so important to me. It's something I have lived for. I never could explain why. Little, nothing touches. My fingers against his shoulder, the outsides of our thighs touching as we squeeze together on the bus. I cannot explain it, but I need it. Sometimes I imagine stitching all of our little touches together. How many hundreds of thousands of fingers brushing against each other does it take to make love? Why does anyone ever make love? My thoughts are going to my childhood, Oscar, to when I was a girl. I am sitting here thinking about fistfuls of pebbles, and the first time I noticed hairs under my arms. My thoughts are around my mother's neck, her pearls. When I first liked the smell of perfume, and how Anna and I would lie in the darkness of our bedroom in the warmth of our bed. I told her one night what I had seen behind the shed behind our house. She made me promise never to speak a word about it. I promised her. Can I watch you kiss?
Can you watch us kiss?
You could tell me where you're going to kiss, and I could hide and watch. She laughed, which was how she said yes. We woke up in the middle of the night. I do not know who woke up first, or if we woke up at the same time. What does it feel like? I asked her. What does what feel like? To kiss. She laughed. It feels wet, she said. I laughed. It feels wet and warm and very strange at first. I laughed. Like this, she said, and she grabbed the sides of my face and pulled me into her. I had never felt so in love in my life, and I have not felt so in love since. We were so innocent. How could anything be more innocent than the two of us kissing in that bed? How could anything less deserve to be destroyed? I told him, I will try harder if you will stay. Okay, he wrote. Just please do not leave me. Okay. We never have to mention this. Okay. I am thinking about shoes for some reason. How many pairs I have worn in my life, and how many times my feet have slipped into and out of them, and how I put them at the foot of the bed, pointing away from the bed. My thoughts are going down a chimney and burning. Footsteps above, frying onions, clinking crystal. We were not rich, but there was nothing we wanted. From my bedroom window I watched the world. And I was safe from the world. I watched my father fall apart. The nearer the war came, the farther he went. Was that the only way he knew to protect us? He spent hours in his shed every night. Sometimes he would sleep in there, on the floor. He wanted to save the world. That's what he was like, but he wouldn't put our family in danger. That's what he was like. He must have weighed my life against a life he might have been able to save, or 10 or 100. He must have decided that my life weighed more than 100 lives. His hair turned gray that winter. I thought it was snow. He promised us that everything would be okay. I was a child, but I knew that everything would not be okay. That did not make my father a liar. It made him my father. It was the morning of the bombing that I decided to write back to the forced laborer. I don't know why I waited for so long, or what made me want to write to him then.
He had asked me to include a photograph of myself. I didn't have any photographs of myself that I liked. I understand now the tragedy of my childhood. It wasn't the bombing. It was that I never once liked a photograph of myself. I couldn't. I decided I would go to a photographer the next day and have a picture taken. That night I tried on all of my outfits in front of the mirror. I felt like an ugly movie star. I asked my mother to teach me about makeup. She didn't ask why. She showed me how to rouge my cheeks and how to paint my eyes. She had never touched my face so much. There had never been an excuse to. My forehead, my chin, my temples, my neck. Why was she crying? I left the unfinished letter on my desk. The paper helped our house burn. I should have sent it off with an ugly photograph. I should have sent off everything. The airport was filled with people coming and going, but it was only your grandfather and me. I took his daybook and searched its pages. I pointed at how frustrating, how pathetic, how sad. He searched through the book and pointed at the way you just handed me that knife. I pointed at, if I'd been someone else in a different world, I'd have done something different. He pointed at, sometimes one simply wants to disappear. I pointed at, there's nothing wrong with not understanding yourself. He pointed at, how sad. I pointed at, and I wouldn't say no to something sweet. He pointed at, cried and cried and cried. I pointed at, don't cry. He pointed at, broken and confused. I pointed at, so sad. He pointed at, broken and confused. I pointed at, something. He pointed at, nothing. I pointed at, something. Nobody pointed at, I love you. There was no way around it. We could not climb over it or walk until we found its edge. I regret that it takes a life to learn how to live, Oscar, because if I were able to live my life again, I would do things differently. I would change my life. I would kiss my piano teacher, even if he laughed at me. I would jump with Mary on the bed, even if I made a fool of myself. I would send out ugly photographs, thousands of them. What are we going to do? He wrote. It's up to you, I said. He wrote, I want to go home. What is home to you? Home is the place with the most rules. I understood him. And we will have to make more rules, I said, to make it more of a home. Yes. Okay. We went straight to the jewelry store. He left the suitcase in the back room. We sold a pair of emerald earrings that day, and a diamond engagement ring, and a gold bracelet for a little girl, and a watch for someone on his way to Brazil. That night we held each other in bed. He kissed me all over. I believed him. I was not stupid. I was his wife. The next morning he went to the airport. I didn't dare feel his suitcase. I waited for him to come home. Hours passed, and minutes. I didn't open the store at 11 o'clock. I waited by the window. I still believed in him. I didn't eat lunch. Seconds passed. The afternoon left. The evening came. I didn't eat dinner. Years were passing through the spaces between moments. Your father kicked in my belly. What was he trying to tell me? I brought the bird cages to the windows. I opened the windows and opened the bird cages. I poured the fish down the drain. I took the dogs and cats downstairs and removed their collars. I released the insects onto the street, and the reptiles and the mice. I told them, "Go, all of you, go." And they went. And they didn't come back.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close by Jonathan Safran Foer. Narrated by Barbara Caruso, Richard Ferrone, and Jeff Woodman.
Happiness. Happiness. Interviewer. Can you describe the events of that morning? Tomoyasu. I left home with my daughter Masako. She was on her way to work. I was going to see a friend. An air raid warning was issued. I told Masako I was going home. She said, "I'm going to the office." I did chores and waited for the warning to be lifted. I folded the bedding. I rearranged the closet. I cleaned the windows with a wet rag. There was a flash. My first thought was that it was the flash from a camera. That sounds so ridiculous now. It pierced my eyes. My mind went blank. The glass from the windows was shattering all around me. It sounded like when my mother used to hush me to be quiet. When I became conscious again, I realized I wasn't standing. I had been thrown into a different room. The rag was still in my hand, but it was no longer wet. My only thought was to find my daughter. I looked outside the window and saw one of my neighbors standing almost naked. His skin was peeling off all over his body. It was hanging from his fingertips. I asked him what had happened. He was too exhausted to reply. He was looking in every direction, I can only assume for his family. I thought, I must go. I must go and find Masako. I put my shoes on and took my air raid hood with me. I made my way to the train station. So many people were marching toward me, away from the city. I smelled something similar to grilled squid. I must have been in shock because the people looked like squid washing up on the shore. I saw a young girl coming toward me. Her skin was melting down her. It was like wax. She was muttering, "Mother, water. Mother, water." I thought she might be Masako, but she wasn't. I didn't give her any water. I'm sorry that I didn't, but I was trying to find my Masako. I ran all the way to Hiroshima Station. It was full of people. Some of them were dead. Many of them were lying on the ground. They were calling for their mothers and asking for water. I went to Tokiwa Bridge. I had to cross the bridge to get to my daughter's office.
Did you see the mushroom cloud?
No, I didn't see the cloud.
You didn't see the mushroom cloud?
I didn't see the mushroom cloud. I was trying to find Masako.
But the cloud spread over the city?
I was trying to find her. They told me I couldn't go beyond the bridge. I thought she might be back home, so I turned around.
I was at the Nikitsu Shrine when the black rain started falling from the sky. I wondered what it was.
Can you describe the black rain?
I waited for her in the house. I opened the windows even though there was no glass. I stayed awake all night waiting, but she didn't come back. About 6:30 the next morning, Mr. Ishido came around. His daughter was working at the same office as my daughter. He called out asking for Masako's house. I ran outside. I called, "It's here, over here." Mr. Ishido came up to me. He said, "Quick, get some clothes and go for her. She is at the bank of the Ota River." I ran as fast as I could, faster than I was able to run. When I reached the Tokiwa Bridge, there were soldiers lying on the ground. Around Hiroshima Station, I saw more people lying dead. There were more on the morning of the 7th than on the 6th. When I reached the riverbank, I couldn't tell who was who. I kept looking for Masako. I heard someone crying, "Mother!" I recognized her voice. I found her in horrible condition. And she still appears in my dreams that way. She said, "It took you so long." I apologized to her. I told her I came as fast as I could. It was just the two of us. I didn't know what to do. I was not a nurse. There were maggots in her wounds and a sticky yellow liquid. I tried to clean her up, but her skin was peeling off. The maggots were coming out all over. I couldn't wipe them off or I would wipe off her skin and muscle. I had to pick them out. She asked me what I was doing. I told her, "Oh, Masako, it's nothing." She nodded. 9 hours later, she died.
You were holding her in your arms all that time?
Yes. I held her in my arms. She said, "I don't want to die." I told her, "You're not going to die." She said, "I promise I won't die before we get home." But she was in pain, and she kept crying, "Mother."
It must be hard to talk about these things.
When I heard that your organization was recording testimonies, I knew I had to come. She died in my arms, saying, "I don't want to die." That is what death is like. It doesn't matter what uniforms the soldiers are wearing. It doesn't matter how good the weapons are. I thought, if everyone could see what I saw, we would never have war anymore. I pressed stop on the boombox because the interview was over. The girls were crying, and the boys were making funny barfing noises.
"Well," Mr. Keegan said, wiping his forehead with a handkerchief as he stood up from his chair, "Oscar has certainly given us a lot to think about."
I said, "I'm not done."
He said, "That seemed pretty complete to me."
I explained, "Because the radiant heat traveled in straight lines from the explosion, scientists were able to determine the direction toward the hypocenter from a number of different points by observing the shadows cast by intervening objects. The shadows gave an indication of the height of the burst of the bomb and the diameter of the ball of fire at the instant it was exerting the maximum charring effect. Isn't that fascinating?"
Jimmy Snyder raised his hand.
I called on him. He asked,
"Why are you so weird?"
I asked if his question was rhetorical. Mr. Keegan told him to go to Principal Bundy's office. Some of the kids cracked up. I knew they were cracking up in the bad way, which is at me, but I tried to maintain my confidence. Another interesting feature that has to do with the explosion was the relationship between the degree of burning and color, because dark colors absorb light, obviously. For example,
A famous chess match between two grandmasters was going on that morning on a life-size board in one of the big city parks. The bomb destroyed everything, the spectators in the seats, the people who were filming the match, their black cameras, the timing clocks, even the grandmasters. All that was left were white pieces on white square islands. As he walked out of the room, Jimmy said, "Hey, Oscar, who's Buckminster?" I told him, "Richard Buckminster Fuller was a scientist, philosopher, and inventor who is most famous for designing the geodesic dome, whose most famous version is the Buckyball. He died in 1983, I think." Jimmy said,
"I mean, your Buckminster."
I didn't know why he was asking, because I brought Buckminster to school for a demonstration only a couple of weeks before and dropped him from the roof to show how cats reach terminal velocity by making themselves into little parachutes, and that cats actually have a better chance of surviving a fall from the 20th floor than the 8th floor, because it takes them about 8 floors to realize what's going on and relax and correct themselves. I said, "Buckminster is my pussy." Jimmy pointed at me and said, "Ha ha!" The kids cracked up in the bad way. I didn't get what was so hilarious. Mr. Keegan got angry and said, "Jimmy." Jimmy said, "What? What did I do?" I could tell that inside, Mr. Keegan was cracking up too. What I was saying was they found a piece of paper about half a kilometer from the hypocenter, and the letters, which they call characters, were neatly burned out. I became extremely curious about what that would look like, so first I tried to cut out letters on my own, but my hands weren't good enough to do it. So I did some research, and I found a printer on Spring Street who specializes in die cutting, and he said he could do it for $250. I asked him if that included tax. He said no, but I still thought it was worth the money, so I took my mom's credit card, and anyway, here it is. I held up the sheet of paper, with the first page of A Brief History of Time in Japanese, which I got the translation of from Amazon.co.jp. I looked at the class through the story of the turtles. That was Wednesday. I spent Thursday's recess in the library reading the new issue of American Drummer, which Librarian Higgins orders especially for me. It was boring. I went to the science lab to see if Mr. Powers would do some experiments with me. He said he actually had plans to eat lunch with some other teachers, and he couldn't let me be in the lab alone. So I made some jewelry in the art studio, which you are allowed to be in alone. Friday, Jimmy Snyder called me from across the playground, and then he came up to me with a bunch of friends. He said, "Hey, Oscar, would you rather have a hand job or a blow job from Emma Watson?" I told him I didn't know who Emma Watson was. Matt Kolber said, "Hermione, retard." I said, "Who's Hermione? And I'm not mentally retarded." Dave Mallon said, "In Harry Potter, fag boy." Steve Wicker said, "She has sweet tits now." Jake Riley said, "Hand job or blow job?" I said, "I've never even met her." I know a lot about birds and bees, but I don't know very much about the birds and the bees. Everything I do know, I had to teach myself on the internet because I don't have anyone to ask. For example, I know that you give someone a blowjob by putting your penis in their mouth. I also know that dick is penis and that cock is penis too. And monster cock, obviously. I know that VJs get wet when a woman is having sex, although I don't know what they get wet with. I know that VJ is cunt and also ass. I know what dildos are, I think, but I don't know what cum is exactly. I know that anal sex is humping in the anus, but I wish I didn't. Jimmy Snyder pushed my shoulder and said, "Say your mom's a whore." I said, "Your mom's a whore." He said, "Say, your mom's a whore." I said, "Your mom's a whore." "Say, my mom is a whore." "Your mom is a whore." Matt and Dave and Steve and Jake were cracking up, but Jimmy was getting really, really angry. He raised a fist and said, "Prepare to die." I looked around for a teacher, but I didn't see any. "My mom's a whore," I said. I went inside and read a few more sentences of A Brief History of Time. Then I broke a mechanical pencil. When I came home, Stan said, "You've got mail." "Dear Oscar, thanks for mailing me the $76.50 you owed me. To tell you the truth, I never thought I'd see that money. Now, I will believe everyone. Marty Mahaltra, cab driver. P.S. No tip?" I counted off 7 minutes that night, and then 14 minutes, and then 30. I knew I'd never be able to fall asleep, because I was so excited that the next day I'd be able to search for the lock. I started inventing like a beaver. I thought about how, in 100 years, every name in the 2003 Yellow Pages will be for someone who's dead. And how, once, when I was at the Minches, I saw a TV show where someone ripped a phone book in half with his hands. I thought about how I wouldn't want someone to rip a 2003 Yellow Pages in half in 100 years, because even though everyone will be dead, it still felt like it should make a difference. So I invented a black box Yellow Pages, which is a phone book that's made entirely out of the material that they make the black boxes on airplanes out of. I still couldn't sleep. I invented a postage stamp where the back tastes like creme brulee. I still couldn't sleep. What if you trained seeing-eye dogs to be bomb-sniffing dogs so that they'd be sniffing-eye-seeing-bomb dogs? That way, blind people could get paid for being led around and could be contributing members of our society, and we'd all be safer, too. I was getting further and further from sleep. When I woke up, it was Saturday. I went upstairs to pick up Mr. Black, and he was waiting in front of his door, snapping his fingers next to his ear. "What's this?" he asked when I handed him the present I made for him. I shrugged my shoulders just like Dad used to. "What am I supposed to do with it?" I told him, "Open it, obviously." But I couldn't keep my happiness in, and before he got the paper off the box, I said, "It's a necklace I made for you with a compass pendant, so you can know where you are in relation to the bed." He kept opening it and said, "How nice of you." "Yeah," I said, taking the box from him because I could open it faster. "It probably won't work outside your apartment because the magnetic field of the bed gets smaller the farther you get from it, but still." I handed him the necklace and he put it on. It said that the bed was north. "So, where to?" he asked. "The Bronx," I said. "The IRT?"
"The what?"
"The IRT train."
"There isn't an IRT train, and I don't take public transportation."
"Why not?"
"It's an obvious target."
"So how do you plan on us getting there?"
"We'll walk."
"That's got to be about 20 miles from here," he said. "Have you seen me walk?"
"That's true."
"Let's take the IRT."
"There is no IRT.
"Whatever there is, let's take it."
On our way out, I said, "Stan, this is Mr. Black. Mr. Black, this is Stan." Mr. Black stuck out his hand and Stan shook it. I told Stan, "Mr. Black lives in 6A. Stan took his hand back, but I don't think Mr. Black was offended. Almost the whole ride to the Bronx was underground, which made me incredibly panicky, but once we got to the poor parts, it went above ground, which I preferred. A lot of the buildings in the Bronx were empty, which I could tell because they didn't have windows and you could see right through them, even at high speeds. We got off the train and went down to the street. Mr. Black had me hold his hand as we looked for the address. I asked him if he was racist. He said poverty made him nervous, not people. Just as a joke, I asked him if he was gay. He said,
"I suppose so."
"Really?" I asked, but I didn't take back my hand because I'm not homophobic. The building's buzzer was broken, so the door was held open with a brick. Agnes Black's apartment was on the third floor, and there was no elevator. Mr. Black said he'd wait for me because the stairs at the subway were enough for him for one day. So I went up alone. The floor of the hallway was sticky, and for some reason all of the peepholes had black paint over them. Someone was singing from behind one of the doors, and I heard TVs behind a bunch of others. I tried my key in Agnes's lock, but it didn't work, so I knocked. A little woman answered, who was in a wheelchair. She was Mexican, I think, or Brazilian or something. "Excuse me, is your name Agnes Black?" She said,
"No speak English."
"What?"
"No speak English."
"I'm sorry," I said, "but I don't understand you. Could you please repeat yourself and enunciate a little bit better?"
"No speak English," she said.
I pointed a finger in the air, which is the universal sign for hold on, and then I called down to Mr. Black from the stairwell.
"I don't think she speaks English." "Well, what does she speak?"
"What do you speak?" I asked her, and then I realized how dumb my question was, so I tried a different approach.
"Parlez-vous français?"
"Espagnol," she said.
"Espagnol," I hollered down. "Terrific," he hollered back. "I picked up a little Espagnol along the way."
So I brought her wheelchair to the stairwell, and they hollered to each other, which was kind of weird because their voices were traveling back and forth, but they couldn't see each other's faces. They cracked up together, and their laughter ran up and down the stairs. Then Mr. Black hollered,
"Oscar!"
And I hollered, "That's my name, don't wear it out." And he hollered,
"Come on down."
When I got back to the lobby, Mr. Black explained that the person we were looking for had been a waitress at Windows on the World.
"What the?" "The woman I just spoke with, Felice, didn't know her personally. She was told about her when she moved in."
"Really?"
"I wouldn't make that up."
We went out to the street and started walking. A car drove by that was playing music extremely loudly, and it vibrated my heart. I looked up, and there were strings connecting a lot of the windows with clothes hanging on them. I asked Mr. Black if that's what people meant when they said clotheslines. He said,
"That's what they mean."
I said, "That's what I thought." We walked some more. Kids were kicking rocks in the street and cracking up in the good way. Mr. Black picked up one of the rocks and put it in his pocket. He looked at the street sign and then at his watch. A couple of old men were sitting in chairs in front of a store. They were smoking cigars and watching the world like it was TV. "That's so weird to think about," I said.
"What is?"
"That she worked there. Maybe she knew my dad. Or not knew him, but maybe she served him that morning. He was there in the restaurant. He had a meeting. Maybe she refilled his coffee or something."
"It's possible."
"Maybe they died together." I know he didn't know what to say to that, because of course they died together. It was just a question of how they died together, like whether they were on different floors or next to each other or something else. Maybe they had gone up to the roof together. You saw in some of the pictures that people jumped together and held hands, so maybe they did that. Or maybe they just talked to each other until the building fell. What would they have talked about?
They were obviously so different. Maybe he told her about me. I wonder what he told her. I couldn't tell how it made me feel to think of him holding someone's hand. "Did she have any kids?" I asked.
"I don't know."
"Ask her."